If you were in here for Steve Weaver's, he mentioned a piece called The Tub Preachers, in which he mentioned a Thomas Lamb who was a soap boiler. That's the same Thomas Lamb, the soap boiler, that we're going to be looking at. There were actually two Thomas Lambs, at least two Thomas Lambs, who were General Baptists of the day. The one we are looking at is Thomas Lamb, the soap boiler, and I'm following Stephen Wright's understanding of deciding who was who, which one of the lambs were which. Our Thomas Lamb, hesitate to do this, it goes against all of my historical training, but to be overly simplistic and anachronistic, Thomas Lamb was a four-point Calvinist, and basically he was sick and tired of hearing his particular Baptist brethren tell him that he couldn't be a consistent four-point Calvinist. He was tired of the jokes of saying that, you know what a four-point Calvinist is? An Arminian. He had heard that enough, and that's one of the reasons he's writing this piece. If you don't believe me, go read the preface and the dedicatory epistle. He says it, just not in those exact words. He's in the General Baptist churches, but he's a four-point Calvinist, and he wants to argue for the doctrine of the perseverance of the saints, and he says he doesn't need limited atonement to do it. That's his concern. So that's who we're talking about, Thomas Lamb. Tom Schreiner and Ardell Kennedy, The Race Set Before Us, it's an important contribution to modern-day discussions on the doctrine of perseverance. There is much to be commended in their work, and anyone wishing to enter in a debate on the doctrine of perseverance must reckon with them as noteworthy discussion partners. Yet for all the merits of their book, as a historian, I must take issue with Schreiner and Kennedy's presentation of the exegetical and theological positioning of 17th century Puritan England. Schreiner and Kennedy find fault with the particular Calvinistic approach to biblical warning passages that they term the tests of genuineness view. Again, this is a modern day discussion that they're dialoguing with. Now they claim that those who advocate this tests of genuineness view believe that the biblical warnings are addressed to people who profess faith in Jesus Christ, but who prove to be false or disingenuous in their confession. Furthermore, the tests of genuineness view sees that the warnings function as tests to prove that the disingenuous believer never truly possessed salvation, so that the true function of the warning passages is to, quote, distinguish pseudo-believers from true believers. Now, what concerns Schreiner and Kennedy most of all with this tests of genuineness view is that it denies that the warning passages are intended to function as means of perseverance for true believers. This is going to come up throughout the whole passage, so note that the main thing is that this view denies that warning passages in the Bible are intended to function as means of perseverance for true believers. Now, in search of a culprit on which to blame this faulty approach, Schreiner and Kennedy claim John Owen as one of the most influential advocates of the tests of genuineness view. They assert that Owen taught that warning passages like Hebrews chapter 6, verses 4 through 6, are meant to facilitate a retrospective focus on assurance rather than provide a genuine warning that projects future consequences that inevitably flow from a persistent departure from Christ. Schreiner and Kennedy charge Owen and the tests of genuineness view with reading valid theological convictions of preserving grace into the wrong texts, and in effect, denying that the warning passages are meant to function as means to prod true believers to persistent perseverance. This paper today seeks to challenge Schreiner and Kennedy's assertion about Owen and their perception of the theological and exegetical concerns regarding perseverance in 17th century England. In doing this, it addresses the question in the context in which Owen and others found themselves during the 1650s. It looks at the perseverance controversy sparked by John Goodwin, It notes responses from John Owen and other Reformed theologians concerning the warning passages and perseverance, and then more closely examines the position of the Baptist contender in this debate. It is here that we will see that Thomas Lamb, rather than the Puritan John Owen, stands as a more viable candidate for Schriner and Kennedy's 17th century precursor to the test of genuineness view. Divine threats and perseverance in the 1650s. Let's look at the context of this perseverance debate. In 1651, John Goodwin published Redemption Redeemed, which was meant to be a vindication of universal or general redemption. As one would expect in Puritan England, it raised a considerable amount of debate from his Calvinistic colleagues of the day. Yet Goodwin's book was not solely a treatise on universal redemption. He saw fit to include a 7-chapter digression in the middle of it on the doctrine of perseverance, denying the Reformed view. Running for nearly 250 pages, this digression comprised over 43% of the whole book. This lengthy excursion drew several published responses that sought to defend the Reformed understanding of the perseverance of the saints. One of these respondents was John Owen, who in 1654 published The Doctrine of the Saints' Perseverance, Explained and Confirmed. Also, in 1654, George Kendall published Sancti Sancti, or The Common Doctrine of the Perseverance of the Saints. This was followed in 1656 by our Baptist friend Thomas Lamb, Absolute Freedom from Sin. Each one of these book-length responses sought to counter Goodwin's argument for the possibility of losing one's salvation so as to vindicate the Calvinistic belief that those who have true saving faith will never totally or finally fall away from the faith. One of Goodwin's concerns about a Calvinistic understanding of perseverance is that it could not properly account for the passages that threaten believers who were not living correctly. Goodwin argues that, quote, the received doctrine of perseverance absolutely overthrows all the usefulness, necessity, and rational congruity of such admonitions and exhortations unto perseverance, wherein the Holy Ghost addresseth himself in the Scriptures unto the saints. So you notice he's pointing out that the warnings are properly to be understood as directed toward saints. He raises particular concern about the Calvinist's ability to handle the warning passages of Scripture, where God threatens people in the church with eternal death. Goodwin posits that, quote, the end intended by God in such threatenings, which threaten those that shall apostatize with eternal death, is to prevent apostasy in the saints and to work or cause them to persevere. The threats in the Bible are meant, directed towards believers in order to prompt them to true perseverance. His argument is that God would not contradict his own intended use of these threats by proposing something else that would hinder them. Goodwin saw Calvinistic promises of a certain perseverance for all saints as granting an assurance of heaven that would leave believers immune to any fear of hell. Thus, according to his view, those warning passages meant to elicit fear of hell were, quote, rendered unsavory by the principles of the said doctrine, or at least useless and vain in respect to any efficiency contributable by them towards the effecting of perseverance in the saints. Now let's look at Owen's response. In response to Goodwin's accusation that Calvinists could not properly make sense of the warning passages, it is interesting that Owen does not give reasons for why warning passages were not directed towards believers and thus were not means of perseverance, as Kennedy and Schriner would assume. Instead, Owen affirms the very concerns that Goodwin raises. Referring to Hebrews 6:4-6, Owen says, quote, the discourse there used by the apostle is peremptory, that men may, without any disparagements to their wisdom or reason, earnestly deal with others and exhort them to avoid falling away from God, though they are fully persuaded that those whom they so exhort, by the help of those exhortations and upon other considerations, shall abide with God to the end, or be attended with things accompanying salvation. Notice, Owen here is directing, saying that the threats are directed towards believers, those people they think are going to abide to the end. And it's by the help of those exhortations and upon other considerations that they shall abide to the end. At another point, Owen states, "Be it granted that one end of God in his threatenings is to prevent apostasy in the saints, by stirring them up to take careful heed to the ways and means whereby they may persevere, and that they no otherwise work or cause perseverance, but as they so stir up and provoke men to the things wherein they are to abide." Again, threatening passages, the warning passages, are means of perseverance. It's abundantly clear that Owen affirms Goodwin's contention that warning passages are addressed to believers and intended to function as means of perseverance in the faith. For the most part, it appears that Goodwin's concerns about the Reformed tradition's ability to recognize the warning passages as genuine warnings, was off course. Owen stands as a major representative of the Reformed tradition on this point. For instance, his view is echoed in the Netherlands by men like Herman Witsius. Quote, "These admonitions, promises, threatenings, and the like actions of God toward the elect, so far from giving the least ground to conclude anything against their perseverance, that, on the contrary, they are powerful means for their conservation." Accordingly, it should be acknowledged that Schreiner and Kennedy's rendering of Owen and the post-Reformation tradition is mistaken, and that in many ways the old Puritan and Reformed position is much more akin to their own. Let's look at Lamb's response. In Lamb's response to Goodwin, we see a different strategy from the one given by Owen. Rather than affirming that these divine threats could be seen as means of perseverance for the believer, Lamb calls Goodwin's premise into question. As Lamb puts it, quote, "No proof appears in it that God hath ordained the threats against apostates as means of perseverance of the saints, much less that it must needs be only and alone by the fear of hell torments." Although he recognized that the epistle, quote, "the epistle to the Hebrews were directed towards true believers," end quote, he quickly retorts that, quote, "such combinations were otherwise useful to them." Lamb could see how the threat passages were meant to point out woeful conditions of the hypocrite, allowing saints to discern who indeed were false professors. He could also see how these threat passages could instill gratitude in true believers for the fact that they did not share in this dreadful condition. But he was certain to say that in these warnings there was, quote, "nothing tending to their perseverance, much less that it should do it by working in them a fear of hell." Lamb is much more comfortable with viewing the warnings as tests of genuine faith than he is with seeing them function as means designed to prompt true believers along in perseverance. Lamb's reason for denying threats to function as means of perseverance stems from his concern that Goodwin's use of the divine threats tends to misconstrue the truth of the gospel. Early in his book, Lamb states, quote, "First, therefore, the main cause in general of my dissent, and wherein is contained all the particular causes, is for that I find by this book the covenant of grace changed from its own nature, i.e., to a covenant of works. And this doth appear in that it is concluded to be a conditional and grounded upon men's qualities and actions, good or bad, and herein the law and gospel confounded, which ought to be distinct. Servile fear is nourished, and the foundation of the faith utterly abolished, in that all the absolute promises of God are utterly denied, the proper essential formal nature of the gospel buried, and the revelation of salvation no way to be attained but only in and by a man's own performances. You'll notice out of that quote, he combines this fear of nourishing a servile fear with a confounding of the law and the gospel, conflating of the covenant of works and covenant of grace. Lamb was concerned that Goodwin's attempt to motivate people to godliness were not gospel motivations. It disturbed him greatly that a, quote, servile fear rather than a gospel fear was promoted as a means of saving grace. Lamb complains that, quote, the tenor of this book saith, rejoice in yourself always, that is, so far as you have been moved out of a principle of fear of being cast into hell by God for unrighteousness to act righteously. Now, on the one hand, Lamb was not alone in his concerns that Goodwin's use of the fear of hell was problematic. Although Owen differed with Lamb over how to view the warning passages in relation to believers, he too thought that Goodwin's preference for, quote, the fear of hell over, quote, the fear of the Lord was inconsistent with acceptable gospel obedience. Likewise, Samuel Rutherford made a distinction between principles of godly fear and a mere law fear. It's important to understand the connection between the use of threats and the theological use of the law. Goodwin's opponents were staunchly committed to the Protestant law-gospel distinction. And according to this, the law can only tell people their duty. And doing one's duty can never be grounds of salvation. Conversely, the gospel sets forth promises of God's favor. So one must ask whether threats are connected to law or to gospel. And the answer is quite obvious. A threat is connected to the law. Since threats are extensions of the law, Goodwin's opponents found great discomfort in Goodwin's over-evaluation of the use of threats for gospel obedience. Notice how Lamb voices this concern. Quote, peradventure, it will be said that it is grace to threaten us with hell forever, to make us forsake evil and do good, that we may avoid hell and possess heaven. But what saith Paul to this? Romans 8:3. For what the law could not do in that it was weak through the flesh, that is, which cannot do what is required out of such a principle, therefore to lead men forth upon such principles is not sound nor safe. For to act from a principle of fear of hell is not to be under grace, but under the law. Therefore, to teach men so as to make Christ of no effect unto them, but to draw them from grace to the law, and under the pretense of zeal and good works to overthrow faith and to bring in another gospel and a perverting of the gospel of Christ. By denying gospel promises of perseverance and elevating divine threats as primary motives of godliness, Goodwin's Arminian sympathies appeared as attacks on the gospel itself. Lamb speaks in accord with the Reformed tradition when he responds, he, that is Goodwin, makes the fear of being cast away from God the strongest bridle against sin, and faith in grace and favor of God and freedom from danger of being cast out of his grace and favor to be the greatest license unto sin, which is a false and uncomfortable doctrine. Now, we've seen how Lamb agrees with the concern of Goodwin's use of legal threats against believers. He agrees with the concern, the same concern that Owen would have or Rutherford have. But let's look at some points of divergence. Where they diverge, where Lamb diverges from Owen and others. It might be helpful at this point to see what caused Lamb to respond differently than Owen and other Reformed theologians on whether the warning passages were intended to be means of perseverance to believers. That is, if Lamb held the same concerns as men like Owen and Rutherford on Goodwin's use of a servile fear, what led Lamb to deny that threats could be means of perseverance while the others did not? Two things stand out as different tacks made by Lamb within the responses given to John Goodwin. The first thing that I detect is the difference that shows itself in relationship to the doctrine of assurance. Now, Goodwin had argued that the threat passages were meant to instill fear of eternal death so as to motivate saints to find ways to persevere, and that a saint having a promise that he would persevere to the end, that would render the fear useless. One of the ways Owen responded to this point was to point out that there were Christians who lacked assurance. And for Christians who lacked full assurance, for them, quote, the combinations and threatenings insisted on may have much that end accomplished by which Mr. Goodwin is assigned to them. Understanding that the promises of perseverance would not prove beneficial to the believer unless one made a conscientious pursuit of godliness, Owen points out that all of Mr. Goodwin's arguments, not being levied against the certainty of perseverance, but men's certainty that they shall persevere, which some never attain to, some lose either in whole or in part oftentimes, are not to the business at hand. He's making this distinction between assurance and perseverance. And while he also explains how the warning passages proved useful to those with assurance, Owen was sure to point out that the real thrust of Goodwin's argument was against the compatibility of feeling oneself under the wrath of God and a full assurance of salvation. What's interesting is that Owen was open to the threats, sometimes functioning as Goodwin described, since he did not think all believers had full assurance. This is something Lamb could not do. Instead, Lamb minimized the role of sanctification in assurance in order to circumvent Goodwin's contention that a life of holiness was a grounds for assurance. His response was that, quote, every true believer that is a child of God knows it, for he hath believeth in the Son of God hath the witness in himself, with the reference being to 1 John 5:10. Therefore, believing that all the regenerate had a full assurance of salvation seems to have played a part in Lamb's coming to the conclusion that divine threats could not be means of the perseverance of saints. A second factor involved in Lamb's denial of threats as means of grace or means of perseverance concerns the second and third uses of the law. The second use of the law is that it convicts of sin and points out our need of Christ. The third use of the law, in theological terms, is that it provides a rule of life for the believer to live in gratitude before God in Christ. Now, what we see in Lamb is that in all of his responses, he argues that threatenings and threatenings are legal tools and therefore are inappropriate gospel means of perseverance. While others also showed great concern over Goodwin's use of fear and threats in a manner of, that resembles a spirit of bondage, they also recognized the fact that the law and the things associated with the law could legitimately be used to drive one to the means of grace. Take Rutherford, for instance. He states, the threatenings to believers, especially such as are legal, if you believers fall away, ye shall eternally perish, these are to believers, though materially legal, peremptory, and admit no exception, yet they are formally, and in the Lord's intention, directed to them upon evangelic intention. Nor do they say that the Lord intends and decrees that they shall eternally perish. Therefore, these threatenings are not to be believed by the regenerate as certain to come to pass in their persons, but only as law motives to press them to work out their salvation in fear and trembling, and to cleave so much closer to Christ as a condition of such as are under the law is apprehended to be dreadful. So you see this second and third uses of the law and the threatenings. It's pushing them back and showing their need of Christ and driving them back to Christ to press them to work out their salvation in fear and trembling, cleaving so much closer to Christ. Likewise, Owen sees a gospel intention in the legal threats when he speaks of threats as, quote, needful to arouse the backsliders, quote, from the condition wherein they have cast themselves. He also explains these divine threats as filling them with an abhorrence of those ways that in and of themselves tend to so dismal an end and issue. In these examples, Rutherford and Owen show a sensitivity to the use of the law within the covenant of grace. They understood the threats as pointing out the relationship between sinful actions and the damning end to which such actions led. By this means, believers are reminded of the sinfulness of sin, their need of Christ, an abhorrence of God-hating lawlessness, and a desire for God-honoring obedience. This is nothing less than the second and third use of the law exhibited through divine threats. Conversely, Lamb does not allow for the use of the law within the covenant of grace. This does not mean that he explicitly denies the second and third use of the law in his treaties. Nevertheless, it is observable that his arguments against Goodwin nullified the ability of legal threats to exhibit the second and third use of the law. As mentioned above, Lamb's main contention with Goodwin was that he nourished a, quote, servile fear by having the, quote, covenant of grace changed from its own nature, i.e., into a covenant of works, and leaving, quote, the law and the gospel confounded, which ought to be distinct. The furthest Lamb goes is to grant that the use of fear and threats is, quote, a restraint from sin, end quote, which happens to be the first use of the law, which is a societal use under common grace and not distinctively related to the covenant of grace. Rather, he consistently associated threats with, quote, the doctrine of the law, which is a ministration of death. While Lamb may not explicitly deny the law's second and third use within the covenant of grace, its affirmation amidst a strong polarization between the law and grace leaves one with little surprise to see him denying divine threats as means of perseverance. One cannot help but wonder whether Lamb's heightened polemic against legal threats opposing gospel obedience led him to the denial of the law as any sort of means of perseverance. Where Owen and Rutherford made it a specific point to distinguish the various ways that threats and fears operate so as to see the warning passages as means of perseverance, Lamb simply denied the point. Conclusion. This presentation of Thomas Lamb's response to John Goodwin gives strong reason to reconsider the historical claims made by Schreiner and Kanaday that Owen stands as a precursor to the contemporary test of genuineness view of the biblical warning passages. It has been successfully shown that Owen and other proponents of Reform Orthodoxy actually understood passages like Hebrews 6, 4 through 6 as divine threats towards believers intended to promote their perseverance in the faith. It has also successfully demonstrated that the Baptist minister, Thomas Lamb, comes closer to a precursor of the tests of genuineness view than Owen, since Lamb's strategy in the perseverance debate with Goodwin was to question the premise that the passages containing threats were addressed to believers as a means of their perseverance. If this analysis also shows that Lamb does not quite fit the suspicions of Schreiner and Kanaday that a test of genuineness view is merely the result of reading one's theological commitment on perseverance into the biblical warning passages, rather, for Lamb, his denial seems less of an inability to see perseverance and threats of hell as logically inconsistent, and more of a result of his teachings on assurance and the law-gospel distinction.